Hi, this is Chelsea speaking. I've been turning and turning since last week's jury break, and I feel it's necessary for me to explain not only why that information was important to our story, but why it was important to me. Since I can remember, I've been watching Marilyn Monroe movies, and when I was a tween, I bought my first Monroe biography. It talked about her death. My stepfather's late mother had a hardcover biography of hers called Goddess, and though it's been refuted since its publication, that book possibly incited my initial interest in true crime. I started reading about her life and specifically her death. And this was the time when the internet was new. There was this exciting generation of information about her death and its collection in this amazingly globally encompassing platform. My vigor has waned and renewed over the years as this information has been generated and questioned and considered and refuted and disputed and elevated and what have you. She's my Moby Dick. She's this case that I'm not solving. No one's solving. Can't be solved. I don't know why I care so much. I do. Bless me. So I'm sorry. I should edit that out, but I probably won't. She's this figure that I initially loved and then intellectually disliked because she seemingly stands for all the things feminism isn't. Little girldom. The marriage of innocence and sexuality, which I find distasteful. Exploitation, yada yada. And then I read this book by Gloria Steinem about her, about Marilyn Monroe, and it seemed to alleviate my guilt over loving her. And I was grateful for that. Marilyn stands for more than what she probably was. She's come to mean more than anyone can mean. It's not her. It's not her the person. It's her the figure, I guess. The time, the everything. And beyond her, I've always been infatuated with the 1960s. Love the 1960s. And one reason why, something that always astonishes me about this period, is how tightly woven the cultural tapestry was. It was the smallest world. It feels like there were a handful of A-list movie stars, a handful of sports stars, a handful of political figures, a handful of musicians, and they all knew each other. And in today's day and age of ever-growing, ubiquitous, varied celebrity and overcrowding, it's just so odd to look at this point in time when celebrity was a small club. In the first jury break this season with Robin from All Time Conspiracies, we talked about two of the main theories about Marilyn Monroe's alleged murder. And those are, the Kennedys did it, and the Mafia did it. Then in last week's jury break, I spoke to the son of a friend of Marilyn Monroe, and he told me he had it on good authority that in her final days, Marilyn was planning to remarry Joe DiMaggio, and that she'd scheduled a press conference. I'm going to use this episode to explain the connection between the Kennedys, the Mafia, and Marilyn, and how last week's revelations factor into the conspiracies that pertain to her death. So we're going to do some diagramming today, and you'll be amazed by the small worldliness, the clickiness, the undeniable high school cafeteria atmosphere that permeates this time in America with the world's most recognizable figures. So, there were two very famous pop culture figures connecting the Kennedys to the mafia. One was, of course, Marilyn. The other was Frank Sinatra.
And then the mist would clear, and somehow all those faces would be me.
This guy seemed to know everybody in the world. For starters, Frank Sinatra was friends with Joe DiMaggio during his marriage to Marilyn Monroe in 1954. The marriage only lasted 9 months. Joe DiMaggio was a fiercely jealous husband, and there are collective suspicions that he grew physically violent with Marilyn Monroe. He suspected that she left him for another man, and good old buddy Frank Sinatra suggested he use a private eye to find out for sure. And he put him in touch with someone because, as we've established, he knew everybody. So 9 days after the divorce, this story is unbelievable, by the way, Sinatra and DiMaggio are hanging out in an Italian restaurant, and they get a tip from this guy, this PI, that leads DiMaggio to conclude Marilyn was shacked up at that moment with another man. So these two geniuses leap into action and collect a fellow crew of guys slash friends slash fellows slash thugs, I don't know. And they grab a camera and an axe, and they speed over to this residence to, quote, like, catch her in the act. They bust into the wrong house. This poor 39-year-old secretary is woken up by a group of men hacking into her house through her kitchen with an axe and taking a picture of her in her bed before she hears, "We've got the wrong house," and they all hit the bricks. That really happened. So this woman, the secretary, sued Joe DiMaggio, Sinatra, and the rest of the raiding party for $200,000 and wound up settling for $7,500, which is over $50,000 today. So it's still a pretty substantial sum. So that actually was the beginning of the end for Frank Sinatra and Joe DiMaggio's friendship. It was deeply embarrassing, of course, once it came to light, and I can only assume their friendship deteriorated further when later on down the road, Sinatra had his own share of trysts with Marilyn Monroe. If you wanted to stay on good terms with Joe DiMaggio, one great method was not banging his ex-wife and the woman for whom he always carried a torch. As for Marilyn and Frank, they were friends. I'm unclear on exactly how she felt about him. There certainly seemed to be no jiltedness, no bitterness there, even though they never had an official relationship. She would insist on listening to his records whenever she had a photo shoot. Her acting coach, Paula Strasberg, once told her on the set of The Prince and the Showgirl, in what I assume was a direction to make her go to a happy place, to, quote, "think about Coca-Cola and Frank Sinatra," unquote. This was recounted by Laurence Olivier. So I don't know what Marilyn and Frank felt for each other, really, you know, obviously in a detailed fashion, but there was clearly fondness there. So, we are in 1960, right? Something important that happens that year, not just in the world, but for our story, JFK becomes president. Frank Sinatra was a huge supporter of JFK and a big influential force in 1960. JFK actually thanked him personally on at least one occasion. Frank Sinatra was undoubtedly a moving figure in the momentum that carried JFK to popularity and eventually to power.
K-E-double-N-E-D-Y. Jack's the nation's favorite guy. Everyone wants
to back Jack. So, everything's rosy, right? If you're Frank Sinatra, the president's your buddy. You have the occasional liaison with the world's sexiest movie star. You're rich and famous, and the world thinks your voice is a drug. Things are good. But you also have another thing going on with you, and that is, you also have these friends in the mob, and you like that about yourself.
All me and all nothing.
But the war changed everything, eh, Baron?
I'm no traitor, Sheriff. I won a Silver Star.
And learned how to kill.
Yeah. Maybe I did. Maybe that changed everything. Maybe people began to know who I was.
Sinatra liked being that guy who was connected. He liked being in the family, somewhat. But it was a double-edged sword when it came to his image. And it really made his life complicated when the Kennedy administration started to crack down on organized crime. JFK appointed his brother Bobby to Attorney General, and Bobby, aka RFK, took up this cause. He made the organized crime and racketeering section the Justice Department's priority. He was the first Attorney General to encourage all the investigative departments, including the DOJ, FBI, and IRS, to work together in beating down the national crime syndicates. It was a very discomforting moment for mob bosses, as one can imagine. I'm actually going to thicken this plot a little more. It's reported, and I personally believe, that JFK's father took a meeting arranged by Sinatra himself with historic mob boss Sam Giancana to garner support for JFK's presidential campaign. And that's because Sam Giancana ran Chicago. That was a terrible accent, but you know what I mean. And the Kennedys needed the vote there. So Sam Giancana agrees and helps get JFK elected in the hopes of establishing a friendly relationship with the president. JFK gets elected. Boom. And so what happens? The new administration turns around and starts slapping down on organized crime, on Sam Giancana, threatening his livelihood, threatening his freedom. So now it's not only uncomfortable for the mob, it's personal. Sam Giancana and Frank Sinatra were friends and business partners in a hotel called the Cal Neva because it's on the border of California and Nevada. Actually, it's at Lake Tahoe, if you've ever been there. They purchased it with Dean Martin because, again, high school cafeteria, everyone knows everyone. The 1960s were insane. I won't get into the history of the Cal Neva because I don't want to get too derailed, but look it up If you're remotely interested, you will not be disappointed. The convoluted, deeply incestuous, and fantastic stories from celebrities and criminals and politicians surrounding this establishment is pretty amazing. I raise the subject now because Marilyn Monroe used to go, and it's believed she was there the last week of her life. Sam Giancana was a silent partner for a while, and he was frequently there. And he and Marilyn Monroe were reported to be friendly. He apparently was deeply respectful to her, treated her like a lady, thought she was sweet. He was a teetotaler, and she was definitely not, but they socialized on occasion. Particularly there. And they had some good times. Rumors exist they slept together. I don't believe them. I've seen no corroborating material to support that, and frankly, I don't think either of them would be motivated to do that. For her part, Sam Giancana wasn't really her type. And for his part, though he undoubtedly found Marilyn Monroe attractive, she was much more useful to him in the world than in the bedroom. I believe accounts of her being loaded at the Calneva, but even given the opportunity, I don't believe he would have taken advantage of her. She was more useful, chatty than violated, and he was not a stupid guy. You don't get to be one of the biggest crime bosses in the world from thinking with your little gangster. So, that is Marilyn's mob connection. The extent of which is that she was friendly with mob boss Sam Giancana and possibly some other friends of Sinatra's, and on at least one occasion, probably more than one, drunk in Sam Giancana's presence socially. Now, that can be dangerous. When you have dirt on the administration and are hanging out with one of its biggest enemies, think about that. It is not a safe environment for any person to be in. That space of being social with organized crime leaders when you're known to have slept or be sleeping with their enemies? But anyway, Sinatra made this connection between them, and she undoubtedly trusted Sinatra. In fact, when Marilyn divorced Arthur Miller in 1961 and moved to Brentwood, the same city O.J. Simpson later struck, true crime shout out, Frank Sinatra gave her a fluffy little white dog, and she named it Moff, as in Mafia, as in Frank Sinatra gave me this dog. That's how unsecret Sinatra's mob affiliations were. None of these things were secrets. People knew Marilyn had slept with the president. People knew Sinatra had buddies in the mob. People knew these things about each other, and yet here everyone was eating in the same cafeteria. Now, switching perspectives, if you're the president of the United States, it's uncomfortable to be good friends with a person who has known mob connections when you start announcing to the world and following through on an agenda to bring down the mob. That's just an awkward dinner party. Which brings us to March 24th, 1962. The story goes that the president was supposed to attend a party at Sinatra's, and then on advice of everyone, probably, he backed out and decided to attend this party at Bing Crosby's instead. He'd rather be hosted by Bing Crosby, a competitive singer, than Sinatra. And apparently he backed out after Sinatra had poured a lot of time and money into preparations for this event. So this was a blow. And what was probably to Sinatra, a message that the friendship was over. This night is significant to us, Deliberations listeners, because several biographers today claim this night was the most likely occasion for Kennedy and Monroe to have slept together. The two were documented to be in attendance. Jackie was not, And it just seems like fortuitous timing and placement. Some are now claiming this was the only time they were physically intimate, and maybe that's true. I don't know. Who knows? But at the very least, I would bet that they did get down and dirty on this one occasion, which was, by the way, only a little more than 4 months before Marilyn would die. It's 1962, and things are happening really fast now. Monroe and the president had already been running in close and similar circles because cafeteria. And while it's possible she met the Kennedys through Sinatra, it's somewhat likelier that she met them through the Lawfords. Jack and Bobby's sister Pat married a man named Peter Lawford, and they lived in Santa Monica, very close to Marilyn. And Peter Lawford was an actor and rich, and they were all somewhat fabulous, so of course they hung out together. The really famous phone call Marilyn Monroe made on the night she died was placed to Peter Lawford. So, whatever. Somehow or other, probably through the Lawfords, possibly through Sinatra, Marilyn gets to know the Kennedys. And she has an affair, the affair of the century, with JFK.
Happy birthday, Mr. President.
When that affair ended, she started an affair with RFK. The way this all came together, I've read about happening in so many ways. The general consensus is that with Jack, it was purely physical and more rushed. With Bobby, it was more emotionally substantive. He was deeper and cared more and gave her more time. That's the most commonly accepted narrative, and it plays into the narratives of her murder in the following ways.
Kennedy theory.
Marilyn has an affair with JFK, suffering delusions of becoming first lady. Her phone calls then start getting rejected, and she's foisted off on his younger brother, who breaks the news to her sensitively that the president cannot see her anymore and gallantly offers her a shoulder to cry on. They then start their own affair, and when his Catholic morals and marital honor compel him to break it off, she's devastated twice over. Becoming more entitled and hysterical with every passing week, her calls to the White House and DOJ go unanswered. She feels passed around and used, humiliated, angry. She also has jotted down state secrets she's overheard in a little red diary. Armed with a catalog of information that would bring down the Kennedys, she schedules a press conference to expose them to the world. Learning of this press conference, Bobby Kennedy leaves his family in Northern California on August 4th, 1962, choppers into LA, and fill in the blank. In some endings, he kills her. In some, he threatens her and then leaves her and she kills herself. In some, he gets her psychiatrist to help him sedate her and they overdose her. To whichever ending you subscribe, that's the general story. She was scorned. He was there. She's dead. That's the Kennedy theory.
The mob theory.
It's taken me a lot longer to understand what would motivate the mob to kill Marilyn Monroe. You'll see in a lot of writings the conspiracy described incorrectly. Beware. An article will say, the mob killed Marilyn Monroe to hurt the Kennedys. Well, that's stupid. How would that hurt the Kennedys? Because the Kennedys were just so gosh darn in love with her, it would hurt their feelings? Come on. If you see the conspiracy described this way, it's probably not a very reliable source. No, the real mob theory begins very similarly to the Kennedy theory. Marilyn Monroe had slept with both brothers and she was in possession of state secrets. She had scheduled a press conference to expose the Kennedys to the world. Same setup. Only in this version, The mafia learns about it because they'd bugged her house, and they had to stop it. Why? Because to the mafia, being in possession of documentation, of proof that the Kennedys had affairs, and or being in possession of confidential state records, was only valuable if the public didn't know. That meant they had leverage on the administration currently trying to take them down. That's everything. The mafia would have killed her to silence her, same as the Kennedys would have killed her to silence her. The only difference is the Kennedys would have destroyed the evidence and the mafia would have kept it. The Kennedys' act would have been one of protection and the mafia's would have been one of threat. Version two, I'd be remiss if I didn't add an offshoot of this theory. As bananas as it sounds, there is corroborating government documents that support the fact Sam Giancana was recruited by the CIA in an assassination plot against Fidel Castro. So, some speculate that he was also recruited to assassinate Monroe. And though she'd be a much easier target, firstly, I have trouble believing the CIA would do this. Secondly, and less passionately, I have trouble believing Sam Giancana would do this. However, given that there's a history of the CIA recruiting crime syndicates for assassinations during this period, it does need to at least be mentioned on this episode. Though I don't give it credence. So, those are the two big theories. The Kennedys did it. The mafia did it. Do you like this music? It's not often I get to be this dramatic in my regular episodes, so this is fun. Okay, that's enough. In last week's jury break, Luke Yenke told me that the press conference was a real thing and that it had been scheduled to announce her impending marriage to Joe DiMaggio. Well, what the fuck? The press conference always comes up when it comes to motive, but the idea that it was really scheduled and to announce something as left field as a remarriage to DiMaggio? That's crazy. That's crazy because it changes our understanding of Marilyn's state of mind at the time she died. If she was planning to remarry Joe, it's unlikely she was moved to devastation over rejection by the Kennedys. It's unlikely she was threatening the Kennedys because she was so overwhelmingly, romantically rebuffed. This idea of a remarriage to DiMaggio is something I'd heard before. I heard rather suppositions of a general rekindling of the relationship, but while there seemed to be indications from his side that he always loved and cared about her and wanted another chance at marriage, I've seen fewer, if any, indications from her side that those feelings were returned. Luke Yenke's information about DiMaggio remarrying Marilyn is supported by a few things. He did plan her funeral. He kissed her on the lips while she was in her casket and whispered, "I love you." He had flowers delivered to her crypt regularly until his own death. And most importantly, because all of these things could be explained by an unrequited love, there was one letter found in her room at the time of her death. It read, "Dear Joe, if I can only succeed in making you happy, I will have succeeded in the biggest and most difficult thing there is. That is to make one person completely happy." That sounds like a love letter, but it's a bit too vague to be conclusive. It could be the note of a dear friend or the beginning of a gentle rejection. In 1962, to Red Book Magazine's Alan Levy, she said, "Believe me, there is no spark to be ignited. I just like being with him. We have a better understanding than we've ever had. With regard to my personal feeling, I always assumed Joe wanted her back, desperately. And while she leaned on him at times of emotional distress, she had no intention to rekindle. Maybe I was wrong. Some information I find too compelling to leave out are the incriminating, yet frustratingly cryptic, statements made by two of the biggest players in this story. As mentioned in Jury Break 1, Ralph Greenson, Maryland psychiatrist, and the person on whom the season's defendant is based, was asked by a journalist decades after her death how Marilyn died. He replied, "Ask Bobby Kennedy." And DiMaggio? Well, since dying, two close friends have written biographies about him, and they both claim he blamed the Kennedys. According to friend Morris Engelberg, DiMaggio was convinced Frank Sinatra introduced Marilyn to the Kennedy brothers in exchange for political favors, essentially pimping her out. He despised the Kennedys to the extent he was glad when they were assassinated. Another friend, Dr. Rock Positano, made even more fiery claims. According to Positano, DiMaggio told him, quote, "The whole lot of Kennedys were lady killers, and they always got away with it. They'll be getting away with it 100 years from now. I always knew who killed her, but I didn't want to start a revolution in this country. I'll go to the grave regretting and blaming myself for what happened to her." Joe DiMaggio's dying words were rumored to be, "I'll finally get to see Marilyn." Thanks for listening. I'm doing a question and answer segment soon. Please reach out to me on Facebook at Deliberations Pod or message me through the Facebook group Deliberations Room.